Several years ago, I was taking part in a discussion on the precepts. And a large part of the discussion had to do with how to deal with ants in your house. How do you keep them out of the kitchen? How do you keep them out of the house without killing them? We went over all the ways in which you can deter ants with talcum powder, cinnamon, paprika. And at the end of the discussion, one of the participants, who hadn't been participating all that much, commented, "Well, tonight we've had a very deep discussion," sarcastically. And the thing was, he was just so dead wrong. Part of the precepts is about this, learning to look more carefully at what you're doing. After all, if you're going to be mindful and alert, you have to be very attentive to your actions and the results. And holding strictly to the precepts is a very good way of getting practice in that. In fact, as the Buddha said, one of the bases for establishing mindfulness is that your precepts are pure. You've learned how to look carefully at what you're doing, and you think about the consequences, and you learn how to do it more carefully as well. For a lot of us, deep issues have to do with abstractions. But many times abstractions are just curtains, films over what's actually going on. Another time, the same group of people were having a discussion, and one of the women had just come back from a retreat where the theme of the retreat was the absolute and the relative, and how to look at your life as an interplay of absolute and relative. And of course, there was the old joke about the relative and the absolute is your uncle in the liquor cabinet. And the absolute in the relative, of course, is he's gotten into your vodka. But as she was talking about the absolute and the relative and trying to apply it to her lives, you could see it was just getting more and more confused. So it's good to strip things down to actual concrete details. And the precepts are a very good way of doing that. And meditating on your precepts are an important part of the practice. One of the defining features of the forest tradition is the interplay among virtue, concentration, and discernment. Usually they're taught three in a row like that. You start with virtue, and then when that's good, then you learn concentration, and then when that's good, you work on your discernment. But from the very beginning, Ajahn Mun realized that you can't do it that way. You have to use all three simultaneously. So they strengthen one another. In other words, you also use the concentration to firm up your virtue. You use your discernment to firm up your concentration and your virtue. And so thinking about the precepts is an important part of the meditation. It comes under right effort and generating desire to avoid unskillful qualities. And so you look at your precepts, one, to ask yourself, are there times when I'd want to break them? If you don't hold thoroughly to the precepts, this meditation breaks down. I've seen people say, well, the precepts don't have to be followed all that carefully. One argument is that they're not divine commandments, as if only divine commandments had to be followed carefully. After all, they're training rules, and you can't train in them if you have some assumptions of your own. You say, well, in this case, the precepts have to be put aside because I've got something that's more important. Denies you the opportunity to look into what you think is more important and start questioning it. Another argument I saw recently is that the precepts aren't even as important as civil law. Civil law has exemptions, they said, so therefore the precepts must have exemptions. Again, the civil law is not there to train us for the purpose of true happiness. It's just to keep us from killing one another or running into one another on the road. The precepts, though, are for you to look at your actions and to figure out where you're causing unnecessary stress and suffering. They're elemental to the practice. And as I said, if you hold to them carefully, you can start looking at your life a lot more carefully and pry up a lot of attachments and also undo a lot of unskillful behavior. Because that's one of the first questions. Where would you be tempted to break a precept? Where would you be tempted to kill? Where would you be tempted to steal? To have illicit sex, to lie, to take intoxicants. The two big ones tend to be the killing and lying. Okay, where would you be tempted to do this? So you ask yourself, and then ask yourself, well, why would you be tempted? Why do you think that that being's life is not worth leaving unharmed? You can't go around protecting all beings, but you can know that, okay, my behavior has not harmed that being. And that's something you can be responsible for. You can also be responsible for not trying to get other people to do the harm for you. Those are the two areas where you really are responsible for things. And so go down your behavior. Where have you been killing in the past? Where have you been lying in the past? The first question is, can you deal with a situation in such a way that you don't kill, that you don't lie? What would be required of you? How many extra pains would it take? How much more careful would you have to be? Say about your speech. Areas where you might lie casually because you thought you could gain an advantage or you could avoid problems. Well, can you still gain an advantage? Can you still avoid problems without lying? How would that require you? The Buddha doesn't define lying as not telling the whole truth. This is an important distinction. There are ways that you can see, okay, if I actually told the whole truth in this situation, it would cause a lot of harm. And as the Buddha said, if telling the whole truth would lead to arising greed, aversion, and delusion, either in yourself or in the person listening, you don't say it. Now, that doesn't mean you lie. You find something else to talk about. You find no way to express yourself that is technically true. In other words, you don't misrepresent the truth. And some people say this is just splitting hairs. That's not necessarily the case. Take the case of that there are people constantly pulling out about, well, after all, there are times when you have to lie, and they start talking about Nazis at the door and Jews in the attic. What are you going to do? Well, first you have to realize there are Nazis and there are Nazis. Some of them, all they need is an excuse not to have to go through your house. They don't want to bother. So you say something that indicates to them that it's not worth their bother to go in. There are other Nazis that, regardless of what you say, they're going to check the house. All too often it's assumed that, well, you lie to the Nazis and they believe you and they go away. That's only some of the cases. So first you got to realize you're dealing with different kinds of situations here, one in which no matter what you say, there's going to be trouble, and the other in which you can deflect somebody, but without lying. So if they ask if you're hiding Jews in the attic, you say, I'm hiding nothing shameful in this house. This has two advantages. One, you can say it looking them straight in the eye. And some Nazis, like some policemen, can read your face. If they're convinced you're telling the truth, and you are telling the truth, they'll leave you alone. The second one is, suppose, okay, you say, I've got no Jews in the attic, but they say, we're going to check anyhow. And they find the Jews, and they come back out. They can give you a lecture on ethics. Not only do you hide Jews, but you also lie. Imagine what it would be like to be lectured by a Nazi. On the other hand, they take the Jews out, they look at you and they say, we thought you were hiding. You weren't hiding anything. You said, I was hiding nothing shameful. There's nothing shameful about what I did. Now, they may decide to arrest you too, but at least you have your honor. And that's something important. Our culture deprecates honor. Being able to maintain your honor is important. It's part of your self-worth. So you're not holding the precept just to be following the letter, but there are actual advantages to following the letter. So that's one thing, to look at what are the implications of your actions and how will they bear fruit down the line. The other is, if you feel you have higher moral standards that lie above the precepts, you might want to question those. Are they really higher? Are they really practical? Recently we've been hearing the case about someone who says, well, in order to protect innocent people, you might have to kill other people. What you've done is you've actually done something really unskillful. And at the same time, what is this requirement to protect innocent people? Is it something you could practically carry out? Is it your duty to protect all the innocent people in the world? How can you do that? People have their karma. You do your best, but sometimes you realize that the karma lies beyond you. And so the purpose of all this is to look and question the views you're attached to. Are they really worthy of attachment? Especially if they get you to end up doing something that really is unskillful. You decide you're going to protect this person by killing that, but what are the consequences down the line? Those things begin to snowball. If you make sure that your actions don't break the precepts and you're not getting anybody else to break the precepts, okay, you've covered what you are responsible for, what you can know. And you haven't let these abstractions get in the way. So these are two of the important reflections that the precepts force on you if you take them really seriously. One, are there other ways you could behave so you don't have to lose what you value, and at the same time you don't break a precept, as in the case of small animals, pests in the house. It requires you to be a lot more careful about how clean you keep things, how you design your house if you have the option of building a new house. In Thailand, they've perfected the ways of making sure that ants don't invade the huts with moats and other things. It takes a little extra time, takes a little extra care, but it's time and care that's well spent, because you're thinking about your actions, you're thinking about their consequences. So you're more careful, and at the same time you learn how to question some of your notions, the things that you hold to very strongly. And this is why holding to the precepts across the board is really important. It's an important training for the mind. You become alert, you become more mindful, more sensitive to things. And that's pretty deep. A lot deeper than throwing abstractions around. So it takes a certain amount of humility to submit yourself to a precept like this. Say, I'm going to put my preconceived notions on hold and see what it's like to really try to live by the precepts. This falls in line with another principle of the forest tradition, is what John Munn called following the Buddha, practicing the Dharma in line with the Dharma. In other words, you adjust yourself and your attitudes and your actions to fit in with the Dharma, not the other way around. So many of us say, well, let's change the Dharma here, change the Dharma there. After all, we're Westerners, we need a Western Dharma, that kind of attitude. Well, how about putting that aside? Saying, well, what would it be like if I really did train by these things? If I gave them respect more than my own opinions? It's only that way that you learn to detect things in yourself that otherwise you wouldn't see. So this reflection on the precepts is good for your mindfulness, and as a result, it's going to be good for your concentration, and it's also a good exercise in discernment to expose corners of your mind that otherwise stay hidden. And to uproot some really firmly entrenched ideas that are going to keep you suffering for a long time unless you get them out.